What to do, Shawty?
Murder stories lull the baby to sleep, okay?
We're a little weird at first, but you get used to us.
We're your favorite sisters.
Except for if you have your own sisters, probably.
No, but I'm gonna be, you know, your favorite.
We're gonna bump them bitches out of there.
Kick rocks, other sisters. No one likes you.
Kick rocks.
Wake the fuck up or shut the fuck up. No one wants to hear about that.
You just told them I like to poop. It'll be an adventure, and we hope that you come along for the ride. Please subscribe.
You'll make the baby cry if you don't.
Yeah, don't upset Ethan by not subscribing. That's just rude.
Welcome to Suspicious,
a podcast with two sisters
who are a bit obsessed with true crime,
unsolved mysteries,
extraterrestrials,
and all things strange.
Stay a while.
Let's get weird. Howdy, y'all. Welcome back to Suspicious Podcast. I'm Jen.
And I'm your rootin' tootin' friend, Angela. Oh no, there's a snake in my boots.
There's a snake in my boot.
Come on, partner. Oh, speaking of partners, I don't know if it was speaking of partners. It probably
was
a terrible segue. Let's see how I segue that. I was going to tell you I got a framed prostitution. What's it called? Oh crap! It's a like not a certificate. I was like, it's not.
I'm certified in prostitution.
No, I got a framed old timey
license?
Yeah, prostitution license.
Oh my god, that's hilarious.
And then I also got a like replica like badge of a brothel inspector badge that's framed.
That's funny. From where?
A couple of my friends who opened a curiosity and oddity shop in Yuba City, California called Curiosity Killed the Cat. So if you happen to be in that area, head in. They have all kinds of cool things. Anna and Amber. What? Show them some love, buy some stuff, get some cool things.
I went to a Curiosity's place when me and Amber went to Austin, Texas for a vacation. Mm-hmm. And they are very interesting places. So I'm interested. I would like to go.
Yeah.
Where is it?
Yuba City. And yeah, so they just opened it a few weeks ago from when I'm recording this. And they're awesome chicks.
Support a small business.
And you guys, if you're in the area, go support small women-owned business. Go and check them out. They have all kinds of stuff. So
tell them that Angela and Jennifer from Suspicious Podcast sent you. Mostly yes. Angela, though, because I don't know them.
Well, yeah, I know them. Tell them that prostitution license chick sent you.
A certificate.
The certificate of prostitution.
The certified pro.
Boop, boop. But yes, so. Hi.
Hello.
Welcome.
We are back with another, guess who's back.
Again. Oh, I thought you were going to sing Backstreet Boys for a second. Shh. Everybody.
Yeah.
Guess we're back. Yeah.
Suspicious.
We're a podcast.
Yeah.
We're gonna rock your socks off now.
Bam, bam. Okay.
Stories about murder. Sorry. That's so terrible. My friends are gonna be like, please just edit my stuff out of your podcast.
Please never mention that you know me.
Don't mention you have acquaintances and friends ever in your life.
All right. So
so we're on episode 8.
We are. If you haven't checked out episode 7, it was a good one.
It was amazing.
Tons of details.
It was crazy. Jennifer talked about one of the most prolific serial killers to date in the U.S., which was Crazy Town. Samuel Little. Not to be confused with Stuart Little. The mouse.
The mouse. And Angela told a crazy story about Zach and Addie. Spoiler alert. Human gumbo may or may not have been mentioned in the story. Listen for more details. So this week, what are we diving into?
So my story for this episode is going to be a listener requested tale. So thank you for sending in your requests. I did one a few weeks ago or a couple episodes ago that someone requested. And then this is the second one. So this is the story / murder of Lobster Boy. Do you know, have you heard, are you aware?
Do you know the Muffin Man, the Lobster Boy, the Muffin Man? I do not.
He is not a Muffin Man.
I don't think I've heard the Lobster Boy.
Okay. Do you know who Lobster Boy is vaguely?
I don't think so.
Okay, great. Then
I'm a Lobster Boy virgin.
Popping that Lobster Boy cherry. That's gross.
Let me see if I can do what you did.
Okay.
Oh, that's a good one. I've never done that before. That's so exciting.
Ready? I'm going to do it.
That was good too. Oh, the simple joys in life.
Okay. So let me tell you about the murder of Lobster Boy.
Okay.
Okay. So first, before we talk about anything else, we need to talk about ectrodactyly. What is ectrodactyly?
Yeah.
Very, very hard word to say. Let me spell it for you because I had to actually write the pronunciation out because I was like, there's no way I can pronounce this because I can't even pronounce regular words since I said pronounce and not
I was going to say you can't even pronounce.
Words are a struggle. But this word is spelled ectrodactyly.
Ectrodactyly. Ectrodactyly. Okay.
Okay. So, ectrodactyly is a rare congenital abnormality that makes the hands look like lobster claws. As the middle fingers are either missing or they're seemingly fused to the thumb and the little finger.
Oh, so it's like Spock.
It's, yeah, right? It, kind of, yeah. It's like, or they'll just have hands like this.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know the listeners couldn't see that, but no. I did. So one up for me.
It made it look like a little lobster claw. I just moved my thumb. Anyway, so okay. So the condition is commonly known as lobster claws, and frequently the condition happens both in the hands and the feet. So that's what ectrodactyly is.
So I'm assuming Lobster Boy had that condition.
So, yes. So on June 26th, 1937, in Pittsburgh, Grady Franklin Stiles Jr. was born. Grady Jr. was born with ectrodactyly, the condition, and this affected both his hands and his feet. This condition was very common in the Stiles family, and it can actually be traced back to the 1840s. So over 100 years that his family has had that condition.
Wow.
Grady Jr. was the fourth generation of Stiles to be born with this. Many people saw this condition as a disability, but the Stiles family came to see this as an opportunity. Grady Jr. was the fourth child born to Grady Stiles Sr. and Edna. Grady Sr., and I'm going to refer to them by their, like, because a lot of people, just as a heads up, people in the story are juniors or seniors or thirds.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to refer to them as their first name and then junior or so forth.
Yeah.
Or senior. Because it just, it'll make it easier. So anyway, Grady Jr. was the fourth child born to Grady Stiles Sr. and Edna. Grady Sr. was a sideshow performer and he had an attraction in a traveling carnival, which he capitalized on his deformities. When Grady Jr. was about 7 years old, his dad added him to the carnival act and they traveled from town to town, in the carnival circuit. In the off season, the Stiles, as well as many other carnival circuit performers, stayed or lived in Gibson, Florida, I think because the weather was nicer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where they stayed in the off season. Otherwise, they were traveling. Grady Jr. Never concerned himself with the opinions of others or onlookers, the gawkers. He was only there basically to put on a show and kind of get money. And as Grady Jr. grew up, he became immensely strong. Even though some of the time Grady Jr. was in a wheelchair, as his condition made it very it made it unable for him to walk because his feet were almost like where your foot would be. It was like split kind of down like a flipper, basically, is how they described it. So his he was unable to walk, but he would almost commonly use his hands and his arms to get around, making him have a lot of upper body strength. So he was very, very strong. Grady Jr., however, was known to have a very bad temper. He was an alcoholic, and he is known for being very abusive, both physically and verbally. Grady met his first wife, Mary Teresa, in the carnival circus when she was about 19. She had run off to join the carnival. She left to escape her life that was filled with abuse, and she felt that she belonged with the carnivals and felt more at home surrounded by the people in the sideshows and or freak shows, as they were known, the people with the shocking abnormalities and deformities. Mary did not have any abnormalities or congenital deformities, so she was like normal.
Yeah.
But she met Grady Jr., and Mary and Grady Jr. were married in 1958, and they had two daughters together. Donna was the first. She did not have ectrodactyly, but Kathy, their second daughter, did have the condition. Mary did say that whiskey made Grady Jr. turn from a caring, loving father into a battering, abusive brute.
Just specifically whiskey? Or
I guess that was his drink of choice.
Got it.
She said that he would wake up at 8 a.m., be great, and then start drinking. So then by 10 a.m., he'd be terrible for the rest of the day. One thing the family didn't struggle for was money. They would make anywhere from $50,000 to $80,000 per carnival season. Grady Jr., of course, was considered to be the star of the show, as with him, what you came to see is what you got. There were no tricks, no gimmicks, no sleight of hand, nothing. It was like, you came to see Lobster Boy, you got Lobster Boy. But unfortunately, money couldn't help or make right the abuse that Grady Jr. would afflict on his family. So in 1973, the marriage between Grady Jr. and Mary ended when Grady had launched himself at her, took her down to the floor, ripped her pantyhose, and reached up with his claw hand to rip out her IUD, which IUD is an intrauterine device that prevents pregnancy.
Yeah, that's nuts.
Then, so that's not even it. So then he used her own hands to choke herself. So she was so obviously disgusted and horrified and emotionally wounded from this that she wisely left Grady Jr. But, okay.
So he made her choke herself, but she didn't die.
Correct. She lived.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So she left him. But according to Donna, which was Grady's daughter, Grady Jr. took his kids and moved to Pittsburgh. And then he married a woman named Barbara. So together, Barbara and Grady Jr. had a son named Grady Stiles III. Grady Stiles III was also afflicted, or not afflicted, but like also had a ectrodactyly.
I think afflicted is appropriate. Yeah.
So he was also afflicted with ectrodactyly. Then in 1978, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Donna, again, Junior's daughter, was 17 at the time. She had run away with her boyfriend, Jack Tame, and they announced that they wanted to be married. Grady Jr. was not having any of it and didn't approve their marriage. And Donna told Grady Jr. that if he didn't let them get married, they were still going to live together. And she also told them that she was pregnant, which she wasn't. It was a lie. She was just trying to get him to approve of the marriage.
Yeah.
So she really just wanted out of the abusive home that she was living in, and she just wanted away from her very drunk and abusive father. So one day, finally, Grady Jr. summoned Jack Tane to have a private talk. And Donna was excited about this, hoping that, you know, it seemed like Grady Jr. was going to put the blessing on the marriage and kind of let them start their lives. Mm-hmm. So when Donna and Jack arrived to meet with Grady Jr., Grady Jr. was sitting on the porch waiting for them. He then proceeded to shoot Jack with two shotgun blasts.
Wow.
Jack Tane died in Donna's arms. And Donna said that my dad was just sitting up on the porch smiling. And he said, I told you I would kill him.
I mean, and shotgun blasts are like gnarly because they like spray out mm-hmm. all crazy, or usually, depending on how close you are, can like blast a hole in someone.
Yeah. And so he, I'm sure it didn't say, but I'm sure Jack had a bunch of big holes in him.
Probably. You know? Yeah.
So Grady, obviously he had openly confessed, and they went to trial for the murder of Jack Tane. And at trial, Grady Jr.'s defense attempted to get the jury to take pity upon him because of his condition. And the defense played heavily on the fact that Grady Jr. had an unfortunate life and that he was driven to drinking and violence by the incessant struggles he had faced. And Grady Jr. even managed to shed some tears at the trial. Crocodile tears.
For real.
So not sure if this swayed the jury or not, but they took 3 hours to bring back a verdict. They brought back the third-degree murder conviction. However, he was not sentenced to prison or like a state institution, as no state institute would be equipped to care for an inmate with ectrodactyly. And as well, Grady Jr. had been diagnosed with cirrhosis of the liver from obviously his heavy drinking, and he had been diagnosed with emphysema, which was because he would smoke 3 packs of cigarettes a day.
Mm.
So he sounds like he smells amazing. So he actually was sentenced to 15 years probation that was to be served at his home under house arrest. So at home.
Did he still live with any kids at this point?
Yeah, he had all his kids. He had the kids that had ectrodactyly with him because they were still performing that I'm aware of. So, and remember, Donna was the one who didn't have ectrodactyly.
Yeah.
Okay. So, so it said that, at first he stopped drinking when he came home, but, and sometime during that period of when he stopped drinking, he divorced his second wife, Barbara.
I wonder if he removed her tampon with his claw or IUD.
I don't know. I didn't say, but they divorced. And then for some reason, some say love, I don't know. Mary decided to get back with Grady Jr.
The first wife.
Uh-huh. And not only that, but they remarried in 1989.
What an idiot.
So she did admit, like, at first that he was not drinking. And so I think that's why she got back with him.
Mm-hmm. Like, but he changed.
Yeah. Unfortunately, after they remarried, the drinking and violence started up again. And he began to abuse Mary and beat his kids again. This time, the abuse was a lot worse than before. And Mary said, 2 weeks later, he was back to his same old Grady.
Wow.
So Mary said that he would sexually abuse her in copious amounts. He tried to smother her with a pillow once. One morning, she woke up to his breath reeking of whiskey. He was on top of her with a butcher knife to her throat and said,
oh my God,
quote, one of these days, I'm going to kill you and your family, unquote.
What the hell?
Then he proceeded to just drop the knife and calmly crawl off of her. She said something had to be done. So family would say that Grady Jr. would also be drinking on stage at this point and would lunge at the marks or carnival goers to scare them. And Lobster Boy's children, Grady Jr., children, Kathy and Grady Stiles III, again, both who had ectrodactyly, could not say enough bad things about their father. He would drag both on stage to show them, to show the he would drag both of them on stage to show how they inherited the lobster claws. And Kathy said that her dad was Satan himself. Wow. She said that he refused to allow Kathy or Grady III to venture out into the carnival midways unless they were wearing large leather gloves so that the carnival goers or the marks couldn't get a free peek at their condition. Kathy also stated that when she was about 7 months pregnant a few years earlier, her drunken father knocked her out of her wheelchair when she tried to stop him from swatting at her mother. The next morning, Kathy had to be taken to the ER and have an emergency C-section. She had her daughter who was born premature and also born with ectrodactyly. The daughter did survive, and now she's the sixth generation born with this condition.
That's crazy. It must be like a dominant gene.
Mm-hmm. And in order to protect herself, her daughter Kathy and her stepson Grady the third, in 1992, Mary went to her oldest son, Harry Glenn Newman the third, who was a teenager at the time. Harry was her son from her marriage to a midget, Harry Glenn Newman Jr. This marriage happened when her and Grady had previously split. Harry was normal size with a round face, and he was kind of pudgy. Oh, sorry. Harry Jr.
Jr.
Sorry. Harry Jr.
Okay.
The kid. Not Harry Sr. was a midget. Harry, her son, was born of normal size, and he had a round face, and he was kind of pudgy. And he was reported to only have an IQ, though, of 79. He also performed in the sideshows, and he was known as the human blockhead, where he would drive nails into his nostrils.
The son?
Mm-hmm. Harry Jr. Sorry, Harry the Third. Harry the Third. No. I take it back. It's Harry the Third.
Oh, Harry Jr. is who she married.
Harry Jr. is the midget she married. Harry the Third. So from now on, I'm just going to call him Harry because we're not going to talk about his dad.
Okay.
So Harry was the son. He was born normal size. He had an IQ of 79, and he was known as the human blockhead. So Mary gave her son Harry $1,500 to hire someone to kill Grady Jr. Harry hired a classmate and fellow sideshow performer named Chris Wyant, who was 17. He said that, or it was said that Wyant had gang ties, but we're not sure because it wasn't really clear, but I just saw it somewhere. It said that he possibly had gang ties. And on November 29th, 1992, according to Grady Stiles III, Mary and Grady Jr. were arguing, and Mary said, "Something has to be done." And Harry had overheard this, then repeated it to the neighbor, Chris Wyant. Shortly after the argument, Grady Jr. Was smoking a cigarette on the sofa in his undies, drinking a glass of iced tea, watching TV. And Mary told Grady Jr. that she was going to go for a quick visit with some relatives nearby. And he reportedly told her, "Hurry back."
With the face that he made.
"Hurry back for more beatings." No, but so after she left, Chris Wyant entered Grady's home and put two rounds with a .32 caliber Colt automatic pistol that he had gotten from a companion in the back of Grady Jr.'s head, killing Grady Jr. at the age of 55 years old. Most of the carnies agreed with the later prosecution of the case that it was a murder of convenience. Stiles Jr.
A murder of convenience as opposed to, like, what does a murder of convenience mean? It was convenient to murder him? Because, like, yes, so my thinking is, like, I don't necessarily condone that they hired to kill him, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in the same regard, it was almost like self-defense. Like, not really, because it wasn't in the moment when he was, like, actively beating her and, like, she killed him in self-defense. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm not sad that he's...
I think just because the opportunity presented itself, so it was, that's kind of like a murder of convenience. Mm.
Is that looked at as, like, less than, or?
No, I don't think so. Hmm. I think it still looked at the same.
Yeah.
So, Grady Jr., he was so hated by the local community that only 10 people came to his funeral. Wow. And no one volunteered to be a pallbearer to help carry his casket.
That says a lot about you, guy.
Grady Jr. was buried in a showman in the Showman Cemetery. And apparently a bouquet of flowers did adorn his casket with a banner that said, "From your loving wife."
Seriously?
Yeah.
Oh, but like sarcastically?
I don't know if it was, but it happened. And so Mary, her son Harry, and Chris Wyant were all charged in Grady Jr.'s death, and all were eventually convicted. Chris Wyant was convicted of second-degree murder and was sentenced to 27 years. Harry, at his trial, claimed that he only joined the plot to protect his mother. Mary tried to convince Harry to take a plea deal, but he didn't, and the jury took 1 hour to bring in a verdict of first-degree murder, naming Harry as the mastermind behind the whole murder plot.
Wow.
He was sentenced to life in prison with no possibility of parole for at least 25 years.
Wow.
Mary was charged with first-degree murder, but ultimately convicted of manslaughter. She was sentenced to 12 years behind bars. She had unsuccessfully appealed her conviction, and then finally started to serve her sentence in February of 1997. Wayne Murray, a former sideshow banker. Wayne Murray, a former sideshow barker, said that Mary went about it the wrong way. Quote, she would have stood a better chance had she just turned around and killed him herself. Mm-hmm. He said, he also added, quote, people can at least relate to that. It's also quoted, quote, all she had to do was walk away, unquote, said Janine Tomini, 77, who was the world's oldest living half lady. She stood at 2 feet, 6 inches tall, and she was born without legs.
Wow.
So Kathy Stiles and her half-brother, Grady Stiles III, survive now on government disability checks. Lobster Boy, Grady Stiles Jr., his story can be found in books such as Lobster Boy, The Bizarre Life and Brutal Death of Grady Stiles Jr. by Fred Ronson. E! True Hollywood Story did a story on him called The Murder of Lobster Boy. A&E also did a City Confidential episode based on the case called Gibson, The Last Sideshow. His likeness has appeared on Silverchair's album called Freak Show. He appeared also in a Deadpool comic as well as in American Horror Story Freak Show. As one of the characters has lobster boy hands for characteristics. And apparently there was also a graphic novel that depicted the whole story, including the murder, called American Freak Show, The Terrible Tale of Sloth Boy. And lastly, one of my other favorite comedy podcasts, history podcasts that I listen to is The Dollop. The Dollop also did an episode on him.
Interesting.
And that is the murder of Lobster Boy the murderer.
I mean, I agree with whoever it was that said that she would have had a better chance if she just killed him herself, because I mean, realistically, it would have been more geared towards self-defense because he was beating her and just a horrible person.
Yeah. Well, it sucks too because her son, who apparently obviously has a lower IQ, was charged as being the mastermind when I don't think he was the mastermind behind it. She was the one who set motions into everything, but he's the one
put the little,
the gears turning.
Yeah.
But he was the one who got the harsh sentence, the harshest one.
Yeah.
Also, Grady friggin' murdered somebody and then he gets house arrest for 15 years.
Right.
Like, okay.
It just doesn't seem
fair. But yeah, so, but,
you know,
if you look at pictures of him or like, we'll post him anyway, but if you type in Lobster Boy, you'll see like super famous pictures of him. He has claw hands and claw feet. He's probably wearing like a yellow. Mm-hmm. He's probably wearing like a yellow, it's kind of like yellow shirt, or maybe that's from the Silverchair album.
Oh yeah. I see his hands. Interesting.
Didn't you watch American Horror Story Freak Show?
I did not. I've not watched any of the American Horror Stories. Oh, I know.
The worst.
I know.
You are the literal
I'm worst. At the top of
it's
the
so
list.
Good.
Worst.
They're good. Freak Show was one of my favorite ones. Freak Show was good. I really like that one. And then, but I love like old timey circus things like that anyway. Like I like Water for Elephants because it takes place like the 20s, 30s.
Yeah.
And it's like old timey circusy. But
well,
also,
and it's kind of nice that like people with disabilities that are like strange and like normally they'd want to like hide away can kind of make a living for themselves by showing off.
Mm-hmm. I was going to tell you, so American Horror Story Freak Show is really good. American Horror Story, the hotel is really good.
I've heard people say they like Coven.
Coven is really good too. Coven's one of my favorites. Hotel is one of my favorites. Freak Show is one of my favorites.
Yeah, I haven't seen any of them. But I'll put them on the list and maybe one day I'll watch them. No promises. I can't believe that his wife went back to him.
I know. That's the thing, too. I was waiting for your face on that one. I was like, oh, and then guess what? They got married. Like, you're like, just like your face when I was like, oh, yeah, he ripped out her IUD. And you're like, what?
That's crazy to me.
Yeah.
Because those are pretty far up there.
I mean, there's a string and you just pull it out. It comes out pretty easy with little pain. But, I mean, there's like no pain.
Oh, our IUD. Wait, I thought
it's
IUD.
It's the T thing. The thing that.
Yeah, but isn't it like.
It has a string.
It's supposed to be. I thought it was supposed to be like medically removed.
No. Well, the doctor's supposed to remove it. But you could theoretically. All they did when I had to get mine out. Before we had the baby.
Yeah.
Or before we started trying to have the baby. They just pull on the little string and it comes right out. They have to be inserted medically, which sucks. Trust me. I had to get another one. TMI. I had to get another one after we had the baby because I was like, not having another
baby. I'm not trying to be a fertile mother right now.
Nope. Not happening. One is plenty. Thank you.
One and done?
I think I'm one
for
and
now.
Done. I'm pretty much one and done forever, but we'll see. But it was definitely painful to have that this time.
But it's further up than like
it's in your uterus.
Yeah, so he had to get up in there with his claw. That was a really good story. I never heard that one before.
Yeah, and that was actually a listener requested story from my friend from high school, Roxanne.
Roxanne.
She recommended us do Lobster Boy. That was not even in the same key. It wasn't even in the same tone.
It wasn't the same
melody. That was the worst. Why did I have you re-record this?
Roxanne. She don't wanna. Wait, she really wanna hear about Lobster Boy? Roxanne.
She likes the circus freak show stories.
Thanks, Roxanne.
Yeah, thanks. That was a good story. And it actually took a while to research because I wanted to do.
Plus, it was probably hard to keep track of all the.
Oh, my God. The names were so confusing.
Seniors and the thirds and the.
Like I said, I even got confused when I was. Because I left one of them off and I was like, shoot, wait, who am I talking about? I'm like, was it a junior, a senior, a third? I don't know. Stop naming your kids after yourself. That's my requested listener tale.
Listener request.
That's
our theme song for them.
No. It's a listener request song. No, that's wrong. That's the story.
You're like, that's wrong. Like, there's a right.
It's a listener requested story.
You want to hear it, and we want to say it.
You want to hear it, and we want to say it. That has to go in there somewhere.
Hey, guys. So when I'm editing this podcast, I realized that there was an error with my audio files during my story, and it's a little echoey and a little bit softer than the rest of the recordings. I apologize. I wasn't able to edit it much in post to correct it, but hopefully the next episode's better. Okay, thanks.
So, Lobster Boy, great story. What I did to tie my story in was I typed in to Google seafood murders. And I found a story.
story.
Fucking seafood murder.
So funnily enough.
Because his name is Lobster Boy.
Yeah, so I was like, how can I tie this to something? And I was like, seafood murders. Like, has anyone murdered anybody over seafood? Couldn't find a story like that. But I found a story
disappointing.
Of Albert Fish.
Oh, okay. I heard of him.
I figured he probably had because it was like super old timey times.
Yeah, he's a bad dude.
Yeah. So, trigger warning, there's crimes against children here. So if you're not comfortable hearing a story like that, there's not like super graphic detail, but anyways. So just
like you're listening to a true crime podcast, you're going to hear about murder and things.
Yeah,
like,
but
it should be self-explanatory, but okay.
Just in case. Okay. So, born on May 19th, 1870 in Washington, D.C. to Randall and Ellen Fish, Hamilton Howard Albert Fish had many names. The Brooklyn Vampire, the Werewolf, wow. I feel like I'm having an Angelo moment. Because you're always like, I can't speak.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Werewolf.
The Werewolf of Wisteria and the Gray Man. As a child, Fish was plagued by mental illness, as were a number of his family members. Not only was his brother in an asylum, but his uncle had been diagnosed with mania, while his mother routinely experienced visual hallucinations. His father was 75 years old at the time of Fish's birth and died when Albert was just 5 years old. His widowed mother didn't have the resources to care for Albert and his three siblings alone and left them with a state orphanage. St. John's Home for Boys, an orphanage located in Albany Avenue and St. Mark's Avenue, where Albert Fish spent much of his childhood. It was there that he conceived a passion for pain. The caretakers at the orphanage regularly beat the children and even occasionally encouraged the children to hurt each other. But while the other children lived in fear of painful punishments, Albert Fish reveled in them.
He was like, yeah, baby, bring it on.
I get to spank the shit out of other people? Fuck yeah. Quote, I was there till I was nearly nine, and that's where I got started wrong, Fish later recalled. Quote, we were unmercifully whipped. I saw boys doing many things that they should not have done. He came to enjoy and associate the pain with pleasure, which would later seep into sexual gratification. When his mother became mentally stable and financially self-sufficient enough to take him home in 1880, she removed him from the orphanage. But the damage had already been done. Fish not only continued to administer his own beatings, but began an unhealthy relationship with a telegraph boy in 1882. The child introduced him to the sexual practices of, I should have looked up the pronunciation, urolangia and coprophagia, the consumption of human waste. Delicious.
I think it's coprophagia.
Yeah,
coprophagia. And dogs are notorious for that too, by the way. Just
dogs?
Dogs will eat their own poop.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, my dogs. Terrible. Urolagnia.
Urolagnia. Is that one for urine? Liking urine?
Probably.
I'm guessing.
But that's like real foul. Real foul.
That's gross. Hey, I want to.
Could never be me.
You want to come over for dinner? I'm having poop and pee.
That's a poop stew. Extra toast.
This dinner tastes like crap. Well, thank you.
I love the corn in the nuggets. Okay.
It's so meaty.
Eventually, his sadomasochistic tendencies led him to an obsession with sexual self-mutilation. He would regularly... Oh, I just thought of a joke for the... When it was saying that... I mean, this is terrible, but that after he got picked up from the orphanage, he would continue to administer his own beatings. I thought of the liar, liar scene where he's, I'm kicking my ass!
When he's
you
in
mind?
The elevator, beat himself up.
Anyways, okay, back to the story.
I'm my own worst enemy. I'm my own bully.
Okay, so eventually his sadomasochistic tendencies led him to an obsession with sexual self-mutilation, and he would regularly embed needles into his groin and abdomen and flog himself with a nail-studded paddle. And in 1890, after a 20-year-old
I don't know about
fish,
you. Oh, sorry. What? I don't know about you, but I love needles in the wiener.
Just straight. Just
needle just, wiener.
Just needles in the
needles. Ass.
In 1890, after a 20-year-old fish moved to New York City, his crimes against children began. Fish became increasingly curious about the pain of others and wasted no time after moving to New York to learn more. He started prostituting himself and molesting young boys, whom he'd lure from their homes to rape and torture them. A nail-studded paddle was his favorite weapon. Remarkably, in 1898, Fish married a woman his mother had introduced him to and fathered 6 children with her. Wow.
Disgusting.
Super
disgusting. Especially since he likes to clearly do things to children.
Yeah. But it says that while he never violently abused his children, Fish continued raping and torturing other children throughout their childhood. In 1910, while working as a house painter in Delaware, Fish met Thomas Kedden. Fish and Kedden began a sadomasochistic relationship, though it is unknown how much of it Kedden actually consented to. In later descriptions of the affair, Fish would hint that Kedden was perhaps intellectually disabled, which is super sad, though it was always difficult to sort fact from fiction in Fish's tales. Only 10 days after their initial meeting, Fish lured Kedden to an abandoned farmhouse under the pretense of an assignation. What's an assignation? I should Google that. Let me Google.
It means an appointment to meet someone in secret, typically made by lovers.
He lured Kedden to an abandoned farmhouse under the false
pretense of
an assignation.
Being a lover.
Secret meetings. So when Kedden arrived, however, he found himself locked inside. For 2 weeks, Fish tortured Kedden. The budding killer mutilated the other man's body and cut off half of his penis. Then, as suddenly as he had arrived, Fish disappeared, leaving Kedden with a $10 bill for his trouble. Quote, I shall never forget his scream or the look he gave me, Fish later recalled.
Cut off half his penis?
And $10, come on.
Oh, and he gave him $10. Like, hey, don't say anything about this, okay?
I'm sorry.
Did he live?
Penis. He has $10.
He has $10.
I think he did live.
Ah, with half a penis.
With half a penis. So, yeah, I don't know what happened to him after that. But
I guess he's not a secret lover anymore.
No. Not no mouth. Not no secret. By 1917, Fish was having difficulty concealing the symptoms of severe mental illness, leading his wife to leave him for another man. Fish's self-harm grew thereafter, from pressing more and more needles into his groin to stuffing wool covered in lighter fluid into his anus and then setting it on fire.
Because wow! That escalated real freaking fast.
I want to know if he took the opportunity of a fire anus and roasted some marshmallows at least. You know?
I hope he farted out of his fire anus and it shot fire out
like a reverse dragon.
Yeah, like he was dragging from his butt dragons. He was like, hey guys, have you seen my new trick? Let me show you butt dragons.
Who thinks to do that though? Like obviously there's clear mental illness there. But who thinks, let me put lighter fluid on this cotton or wool, whatever, shove it up my ass and set it off. Like that's a great idea.
Well, and also, he's absorbing because your butt, you absorb faster through your butt because
so
it's,
we should be drinking through our butts.
No, because you'll get drunk and you'll overdose on like alcohol way fast. Some people do though. Some people will drink through their like
just
they'll
like one
do,
shot and then you're good.
They'll do enemas with alcohol to get drunk so they don't have the alcohol on their breath.
Interesting.
Because you absorb it faster.
But you would still have it in your blood alcohol. Right.
Yeah, it's still, yeah. It absorbs. That's what it is. It absorbs because it's a mucous membrane, so it absorbs a lot faster than if you drink it. Now that you know, don't put lighter fluid in your butt.
Don't do it. Although, if you're trying to get rid of your butt hair, maybe it's a good, just a whoosh, real quick.
I think you would do that on the outside, not on the inside. I don't know somebody who has a hairy inside of their ass.
I'm sure the fire came out of the sphincter, okay?
Is the inside of your butthole hairy? We got a secret for you. We got a tip for you. No, we don't. We do not. Don't listen to that.
So he began having auditory hallucinations as well. At one point, he recalled wrapping himself in a carpet on the instructions of John the Apostle.
It's a magic carpet, right? I can show you the world.
Fiery anus is splendid.
Wait. Shooting fire out my butthole. Can you see the flames?
A whole new world.
Okay. Okay.
Enough. Where was that? Oh, okay. Fish began teaching his own children strange and oddly sadomasochistic games before developing an obsession with cannibalism. As a precursor to consuming human flesh, he began to eat raw meat, meals he often invited his children to share, which I'm sure they enjoyed as well. Thanks, Dad. Raw meat.
Does Dad seem a little weird to you? He keeps trying to feed me raw meat.
It tastes funny. By 1919, his obsession with torture and cannibalism had brought him to contemplate murder. He began to look for vulnerable children, such as intellectually disabled orphans or homeless black children, use that he assumed wouldn't be missed. He would claim at his trial and in later writings that God was speaking to him, commanding him to torture and consume young children. He scoured advertisements in local papers put out by families looking for someone to perform housework, or by young men looking to work themselves. And that's exactly what happened in the case of Grace Budd. In 1928, Albert Fish answered an ad seeking work placed in the newspaper by Edward Budd. Edward Budd was an 18-year-old boy determined to make something of himself. Thus, under the false name of Frank Howard, Fish called on the Budd family in their Manhattan home. Frank Howard arrived at Edward's doorstep with a job offer. He stated that he would like to have Edward come with him to his farm, telling the story of his six children and how his wife had left them. Edward was looking forward to having a job and providing for his family, and Frank Howard even offered a job to Edward's friend, Willie. Frank planned to come pick them up a few days later to take them back to his farm to begin the work. When Frank didn't show, he provided a handwritten note explaining that he would be in touch in a few days. He came over for a visit the following morning, and Edward's family invited him to stay for lunch. During his visit, Frank spotted Edward's younger sister, Gracie. Explaining that he had to attend a birthday party before he could take the boys to the farm, he asked if Gracie would like to join him. With his gracious attitude and friendly nature, the Budd parents gave Gracie permission to attend the party, which is, like, great parenting. Like,
yeah, you're just going to let your kids be taken by this stranger that you just met that you know nothing about.
She's a 10-year-old girl, and he's, a full-ass adult. Like, yeah.
A full-ass adult. Full of lighter fluid adult.
I don't remember his age at this time, but he was a full-ass adult, okay?
Well, when was he born?
He was born... I know I could have did the math, but I didn't. He was born in 1870, and this was in 1928.
So in his 50s, almost 60? Yeah, so
like full-ass adult.
Wait, is that right? What time, you said 70?
70 to 28.
So
yeah, like 58.
58, yeah.
Nuts. Okay, so...
Yeah.
Okay, so the Budd parents gave Gracie permission to attend the party, and that evening Frank did not return and Gracie vanished. Surprise, surprise. So Fish took Gracie, dressed in her Sunday best, to his house upstate, the same one that he had intended to use as a torture chamber for her brother. The family reported her disappearance to the local police and an investigation began. No leads were discovered, partially because Frank Howard didn't exist. By November 1934, so about 6 years later, 10-year-old Gracie Budd had been missing for 6 years. There,
I wasn't even recording right there when I was laughing, but
I didn't need to say that.
About 6 years later, I think. Gracie had been missing for 6 years. Oh.
Imagine that. There had been no promising clues or developments regarding her disappearance until her mother, Delia Flanagan Budd, received an anonymous letter with a description of the mutilation and murder of little Gracie. The note matched the handwriting from the original note sent to them earlier when a man they had known as Frank Howard wrote them explaining why he had not shown up to pick up Edward for work. The letter that they received said, quote, "Dear Mrs. Budd, on Sunday, June the 3rd, 1928, I called on you at 406 West 15th Street, brought you pot cheese, strawberries, we had lunch. Gracie sat in my lap and kissed me. I made up in my mind to eat her." The bizarre rambling letter that Mrs. Budd received on that cold November evening began with the tale of a deckhand who developed a taste for human flesh and ended with a harrowing description of Mrs. Budd's daughter being murdered and roasted in the oven. He wrote, quote, "First, I stripped her naked. How she did kick, bite, and scratch. I choked her to death, then cut her in small pieces so that I could take the meat to my rooms, cook and eat it. It took me 9 days to eat her entire body." Although the written confession was unsigned and nameless, it was the beginning of the end for the cannibalistic serial killer, Albert Fish. During the time of the investigation and before the letter was received, another child vanished, Billy Gaffney, a 4-year-old boy playing with his 3-year-old neighbor, who was also named Billy, disappeared, and the 3-year-old Billy stated that, quote, "the boogeyman took Billy Gaffney." The police didn't take the statement to heart and instead ignored it. Shortly after the disappearance of Billy Gaffney, another little boy disappeared. 8-year-old Francis McDonald was playing on the porch with his mother when a gray-haired, frail old man walked down the street muttering to himself. The mother noticed his awkward demeanor but did not report anything. Later that day, while Francis was playing at the park, his friends noticed that he walked into the woods with an elderly gray-haired man. When his family noticed that he was missing, they organized a search. Francis was found under some branches in the woods, badly beaten and strangled with his suspenders. The manhunt for, quote, "the gray man" began, but despite many efforts, he vanished. The letter that was received by the Budd family was investigated and was found to contain an emblem of the New York Private Chauffeurs Benevolent Association, the NYPCBA. All of the members were required to obtain a handwriting test for comparison to the letters from Albert. A janitor came forward to admit that he had taken some sheets of paper and left them in his old rooming house. The landlady was able to confirm that an old man matching the description had lived there for 2 months and had only checked out a few days earlier. The former tenant was identified as Albert H. Fish. The landlady also mentioned that he wanted her to hold a letter that would be arriving from his son. Detectives intercepted the letter at the post office and were contacted by the landlady that he would be coming to get his letter. The lead detective was able to capture Mr. Fish. Many confessions and testimonies were heard by law enforcement and psychiatrists. Mr. Fish described how he wanted to lure Edward Budd and his friend Willie to his farm to kill them. However, once he laid eyes on Gracie, he changed his mind and desperately wanted to kill her. He took Gracie to the train station and purchased a one-way ticket for her. After the ride to the countryside, he took her to a house. While at the house, he told Gracie to wait outside as she picked flowers. He went to the second floor of the house and removed all of his clothes so as to not get any blood on them. And when he called for Gracie to come upstairs, she was frightened by him and called out for her mother. Mr. Fish choked her to death. Following her death, he decapitated her and cut up her body. He took parts with him when he left, wrapped in newspaper. Police were able to locate the remains of Gracie based on his confession. Albert Fish had many run-ins with police in his lifetime. However, each time charges were dismissed. He discussed the details of the murder of Billy Gaffney, describing how he tied him up and beat him. He even admitted to drinking his blood and making a stew out of his body parts. During his confession, he stated, quote, "I took tools, a good heavy coat of 9 nails, homemade, short handle, cut one of the belts in half, slit these halves into 6 strips about 8 inches long. I whipped his bare behind till the blood ran down his legs. I cut off his ears, nose, slit his mouth from ear to ear, gouged out his eyes. He was dead then. I stuck the knife in his belly and held my mouth to his body and drank his blood."
That's disgusting.
His attitude was not that.
I don't even have anything funny to say.
I know.
More funny things.
His attitude was not like those of people with psychosis. He was calm and reserved, which was out of the ordinary. He confessed that he wanted to inflict pain and have pain inflicted on him. He taunted and preyed on children, mostly boys. He also had a compulsion to write and send obscene letters. An x-ray determined that he placed needles into the region between his anus and scrotum. And at least
That's called your taint or your gooch. The gooch.
Or your little, what's it called, a fleshy bridge or something? There's so many names for it. There was at least 29 needles in there.
That's so weird and gross.
How is that?
First off, how big is your fucking gooch?
I have a gooch that's in. He pushed all the way in, and then they were just in his body cavity. There's an X-ray I can show you. I'm just gonna put it on Instagram. So the trial of Albert Fish began on March 11th, 1935. The defense argued that he was legally insane. They used many descriptions and testimonies to prove to the jury that he was mentally ill. Despite numerous psychiatrists involved in the trial supporting the insanity plea, however, the jury didn't believe this. He was considered to be a psychopathic personality without a psychosis. His trial took 10 days and ended with a verdict that saw Fish executed by electrocution the following year. Fish was executed on January 16, 1936. Before he died, Albert Fish, behind bars in Sing Sing Prison in Ossining, New York, wrote a detailed account of all of his crimes for his lawyer, who never actually shared those writings because they were simply too horrific. And just like a fun fact, although maybe fun fact's the wrong word, but in 2007, Fish's life and crimes were depicted in the movie The Gray Man, which I have not seen, but am intrigued to watch now. And that is the despicable story of Albert Fish, a.k.a. seafood murderer.
That's crazy. Yeah, it's been a while since I heard about him.
I never understand when people's crimes involve children.
Fact that he, would murder and eat them, so gross.
Poop stew and just human calf muscle. Mm.
Well, and if you see a picture of him, too, he definitely doesn't look like a trustworthy person. You'd be like, oh, yeah, kids, go on with him.
Yeah, take my 10-year-old daughter to a birthday party. Sure.
Right?
So strange. So fuck that guy. Glad he got electrocuted.
Yeah, fuck that guy.
He probably would like it, though. So maybe not. Don't fuck him.
That's gross.
I was going to say,
yeah, great. Great note to end on, Jen. Great. Awesome.
Anywho, thank you for listening to our episode.
Oh, yes. Thank you so much. You're so kind.
Please give us a like and subscribe.
And if you have suggestions for our new stories, let us know. You just email us at suspicious at, what is this? I don't even know our Gmail account.
You said it funny too. Suspicious. It's suspicious.
I know. I choked on my spit.
Don't talk. It's suspicious.
If you have suggestions, you can let us know on our Instagram. Yeah, it's suspicious_podcast. Oh, and you can Gmail us.
And don't forget to share us with your friends. Because what is our Gmail, Jen? You've got to get with my friends. What did you say?
What is our Gmail, Jen?
Well, our Gmail is so easy. It's suspicious@gmail.com. That's not German anymore. I don't know what accent.
I'll do it. Hang on.
It's really hard to say that in a German.
If you want to give us likes and subscribes or give us ideas, you can email us. Well, you don't send us likes and subscribes.
Like us and subscribe us in the email.
Send us a subject line of subscribe plus like. We love you.
Yeah. If you're sending us ideas, send us like, subscribes in the subject line. And then say what your subscription wants to be. Follow us on Instagram. We post things sometimes. Sometimes they're funny.
And sometimes they are not.
We'll probably get hate. We'll probably actually get people to review us now, and then we'll be like, 1 star. I would give no stars if possible. I don't like their banter. My name's Karen.
It was terrible.
And I am offended.
Auf Wiedersehen, motherfucker.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Bye.
Bye.